Since that time, maybe a minute or so after that time, I was chided because I did not introduce myself in my session yesterday. My name is Allison Wee. I teach in the English department at California Lutheran University in Thousand Oaks, California. So this is my second summer of teaching staff, which is exciting to do a different kind of staff work than cooking. So it's been fun. I was tasked with talking about literature and in trying to figure out how to do hours for which people haven't necessarily prepared anything in advance. My strategy has been to talk about poetry and language on different topics, and our topic for today is the topic of love. And I've already explained that you will not be allowed to leave here without producing a love poem. A little bit different kind of writing exercises, I think, along the way. But thank you for coming. Welcome. One definition of poetry that has been tossed about over the years, at least since Coleridge and through, I think, Harold Bloom and others, we were talking about this just last night, is the idea that the job of poetry is to make the strange familiar and to make the familiar strange. That poetic language and the work of a poem is to help our minds be flexible and to create relationships between things we wouldn't necessarily see as related, and to help give us fresh language maybe for things that seem common and enable us to see the world anew. And sometimes the things we see every day, a good poet can help us see and appreciate in all of its richness in a way that those of us who are not creative writers can't necessarily access all the time. So on Monday, my session was on the subject of names, the names of things. And one of the things I talked about is the fact that language is a symbol system for things that are difficult to define or to understand. Certainly, any one of our own names by itself does not begin to encompass the originals that we each are, right? But our name is a signifier of some sort that we try to have a relationship to. And the names of things are like that too. You know, a flower, the word flower does not really encompass flowerhood or flowerness in its totality, but it's a gesture toward a thing that is a way that we can understand what we're talking about. So there's this interesting way in which language is always trying to be specific, is trying to be as accurate as possible, but all of the things of the world are difficult to be precise about. And abstractions like love, this feeling, are among the most difficult kinds of things to try to be specific about. Love is one of those perhaps most universal of emotions or experiences, probably as universal as suffering, but we don't need to go there today. But as I'm sure you all know, when we have these feelings of love for another person, for things of this world, for the beauty of creation, you know, those sort of ebullient, large feelings that we have, sometimes we feel rendered kind of speechless, right? It's this thing that words seem to be inadequate or seem to pale in comparison to what we're trying to experience. But of course, those large feelings, and maybe especially the feelings of love that are about relationship, often with another person, it's still something we want to try to communicate, right? We're always trying to talk to each other about those feelings that we have. And you've probably all felt the same thing that I have felt, which is that you just end up saying the same banal thing over and over again, you know? And it becomes in your own ears boring and sort of ridiculous, and you're like, I know I sound ridiculous, but I can't think of anything else to say, you know. So this intrigued me as a topic for our session, to think about the sort of sad cliches that are easy to come by, but that aren't really exactly where we want to go sometimes when we're trying to be specific. So in light of this, one of the strategies of poetry is to use figurative language, figures of speech. Right? I'm sure you all remember the term simile and metaphor, you know, these literary terms for comparing something to something else, either by saying this is like that or by saying that something is that. I am a pig, I ate so much bread and butter and honey. That's what we can all do. So figures of speech, although they are not literally accurate, right? I am not a pig, no matter how much bread and butter and honey I eat, I am not a pig, but it's a way to try to suggest something about the fullness, the stuffiness, you know, whatever it is, that is maybe trying to get at a greater accuracy than if I were literally to say, I ate a lot of bread and butter and honey. Right? There's something that the figure of speech, that I ate like a pig, I am a pig for having eaten so much, that it gets at something in a different kind of way. Figures of speech usually connect things to something concrete. A concrete image in a poem is something that is accessible to the five senses, something that we can see, so an object, a noun, etc. An abstraction of love or a feeling, you can tie it to a concrete image, the rest of us can get at it through our five senses. We have all seen a rose, and when Robbie Burns says, "My love is like a red, red rose," then we have something immediately brought to our mind's eye, and the memories, the smells, the look of a red rose, we all can get at that. And so then we think, here's Robbie Burns is talking about love being related to this thing, this object that I can see. And that is more communicative, more immediate than saying my love is rich and full and big, or I don't know, you run out of ways of trying to be literal like that. So our language is full of tons of cliches for love, right? My apologies to Robbie Burns, but the rose is perhaps the most obvious, the most immediate, the most common image, right? I thought for a moment here, I would give us just a brainstorming minute, if you have scratch paper, to try to jot down a list for yourself of other common images or associations or maybe words or phrases that we have when we think of love. Just kind of let your brain do a little free association there. So, keep your mind generating some of these, but what kinds of things have come to mind so far?
Heart?
Yeah.
A heart, mm-hmm.
Burning ring of fire.
Yay. Cupid.
Cupid, okay. Sorry, my hearing is crazy these days. So.
Warmth.
Yeah. Perhaps a fire.
Magnetism.
A glowing candle, perhaps a large flame.
Magnetism.
Magnets. Cool.
Deep ocean.
Mm-hmm.
I just get flooded with these Hallmark images of walking on the beach and sunsets.
Ah, yeah. Great. That's the direction we want. Sunsets, beaches.
How about the two bathtubs next to each other?
That's
nice. Yeah.
It's the weirdest image. Yeah, I don't know what those bathtubs are about. Those commercials drive me nuts.
I like that.
When do you encounter two bathtubs side by side? I don't know.
Overlooking an ocean.
That's my little mind. So, hallmarkiness, sunsets, beaches. What else was in that little
soft focus lens of flowers?
Fuzzy, hazy sort of sense, the soft edges, right?
Intertwined rings.
Mm-hmm.
And sound.
Soulmate,
mm-hmm.
Music,
mm-hmm. Good.
I was going to say other sounds, and of other sounds, I didn't even think of music, but a baby's mimicking a baby. Baby talk, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Or
yeah,
anticipation.
Sweet nothings.
The Wells Fargo wagon. Anticipation.
Two of the things I always think of sort of quickly are spring and heaven, right? Else.
Some people put the cross in.
Oh, yeah.
I know this isn't as, but I think a needlepoint. You know, all those different needlepoints.
Oh, that's interesting.
Love.
Yeah.
Such as,
I can't even come up with one, but I'm thinking needlepoint.
Yeah. Those are bring up images of monogrammed O's.
I'm going to put roses up here, and I'm also just going to put the sort of giant category of flowers. Right? You know, flowers. Yeah. The blooming, the springness, the giving of them, the colorfulness, you know, they're pretty common as well. Right?
Love
so,
at first sight. I was afraid. Love
yeah,
at first sight.
Yeah.
Many would argue this is not love, but I think of romance novel covers.
Flowing hair.
Yeah.
I don't know quite how to capture that.
Well, the word romance isn't even up there.
Yeah. Cupid, the arrows, the hearts, right? These are all kind of things that are awfully common. I'm sure we could make a longer list, right? We know that there's kind of this land where the lingo jingo of love and romance lives. And because it's so, I mean, I'm not at all surprised that you bring up hallmarkiness, right? We know that there's this sort of type of words and images that end up on those Hallmark cards in like beautiful scrolled print, you know. And yet, you know, although Hallmark cards, you know, are trying to say genuine things, they tend to be sort of in the cliched, sort of hackneyed kind of thing, right? The beach, the sunset, or whatever. And so I think it's common to sort of be standing at a card rack if you're trying to get a card and you want to find something original or interesting, you know? And they're not there in the Hallmark set of things. You know, there's this language that you know, it's not that it's bad. They say pleasant things, but they're just not crisp or sharp or fresh or something. So, yeah. So at this juncture, I thought I would share with you a couple of poems. I'm going to start with the 16th century and the form of poem called the sonnet. You probably all have heard of the sonnet. You may or may not. You may have loved or hated your high school English class where you studied the sonnet form. But this is a form that grew popular in the 16th century in England. It came over from Italy. And for the British, the Italians are the people of love, right? That's maybe an association that the more staid British tend to make, right? Over there are the passionate people. And in Italian, the word sonnet means little song. And these little songs that were popular in Italy, a couple of British writers went over and got taken with this little form of song and brought it back to Britain and started first translating some of the Italian little poems and then started writing their own. And the sonnets quickly became a British fad. All of a sudden, everyone was writing sonnets. It was, in an interesting way, a measure of the chivalric man for a while in the Renaissance period, that if you were a man of good standing and real class, you would be able to ride a horse, do your sword work well, and you would be able to write and recite sonnets to your beloved. So this form was very closely associated with the speaker of the lover, addressing the object of love. And usually, there were a lot of conventions to the earliest sonnets, and they usually were a speaker madly in love, feeling out of control with that feeling of love, but usually in love with someone. It's usually an unrequited kind of feeling, somebody out of reach or somebody above the speaker, so there's all this angst stuff that's kind of wrapped up in the traditional 16th century sonnet tradition is a very particular kind of love poem. So I've got an example of one by Edmund Spenser, and this was written in the 1590s. And it's just numbered. It's Sonnet 64. People wrote sonnet cycles, hundreds of them. Shakespeare wrote a sonnet cycle of 130 sonnets, and some of these are probably poems that you will know to hear them, and we've got one or two to share. But Spenser's writing before, during, and a little bit before Shakespeare. Shakespeare's sonnet cycle gets published in 1609, and this is about 20 years earlier. So, here's the flower cliche. Coming to kiss her lips, such grace I found, meseemed I smelled a garden of sweet flowers, that dainty odors from them threw around for damsels fit to deck their lovers' bowers. Her lips did smell like unto gilly flowers, her ruddy cheeks like unto roses red. Her snowy brows like budded bellamours, her lovely eyes like pinks but newly spread, her goodly bosom like a strawberry bed, her neck like to a bunch of columbines, her breast like lilies ere their leaves be shed, her nipples like young blossomed jessamines. Such fragrant flowers do give most odorous smell, but her sweet odor did them all excel. So that's really taken that flower imagery and everything about the beloved associated with flowers. But of course, the beloved supersedes all, right? Shakespeare, coming along a few years later, he was writing at the same time and aware of this convention, is the kind of wordsmith who was not interested in being conventional. Right. We love and admire Shakespeare to this day because Shakespeare had a way with words that's unlike other kinds of writers. He had a way of talking about things that is less, this could be in a Hallmark card, right? And you'd read it and you'd go, oh, wow, is that ever saccharine and a little overly much. Shakespeare didn't completely reject this model. You might think of his poem, Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate, right? So he thinks of a beautiful thing and then says, you are more, you're superior to these things. But another one of his very famous poems is a direct refutation of these cliched images. And this is probably one you all know as well. But given the popularity of the form and knowing that historical context, we can see that he is very explicitly, this is a jab at all the writers who are writing drivel like this in his mind. My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun, right? He's thinking about all these kinds of lovely images, and over again he says, my mistress is not that. My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red. If snow be white, why then her breasts are dun. If hairs be wires, black wires grow upon her head. I have seen roses damask red and white, but no such roses see I in her cheeks. And in some perfumes is there more delight than in the breath that from my mistress reeks. I love to hear her speak, yet well I know that music hath a far more pleasing sound. I grant I never saw a goddess go. My mistress, when she walks, treads on the ground. And yet, by heaven, I think my love as rare as any she belied with false compare.
Which one is that? What's
that? My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. I don't have the number of the sonnet number written in here.
That's fine.
But it is from that sequence. So, I guess I'm always just kind of interested in observations so far. What kinds of things do you notice about, I don't know, either the fun of that or...
Could you reread the punchline, the last part?
Sure, the heroic couplet, the sonnet punchline. So yeah, he's gone through this list of things, right, and saying all of these beautiful things, my girl's less, not more, right? My gal, not an angel, etc. But then he says, and yet, by heaven, I think my love as rare as any she belied with false compare. What he's saying here is that all of these comparisons, you know, oh, she's so much prettier than the flowers, and oh, she smells more beautiful than any perfume, of, you know, he's saying that's a false relationship. That's ridiculous. That's not accurate. It's an early gesture of realism, right? He's trying to say that not only is that inaccurate, but this strategy of saying my beloved is more than all the most beautiful, wonderful sunset, beachy things that we can imagine, that ends up being the same common, cliched kind of thing. And that actually isn't making the beloved feel rare or unusual, mm-hmm. right? It's sort of a washing out into mm-hmm. this cliche, rather than saying, here are the specific things.
What makes you curious about who his beloved is?
Ah, yes.
Because all these things are not. Mm-hmm. So, okay, he smashes that, mm-hmm. those platitudes, but so you're still left with a mystery.
Yeah. In his sonnet sequence of 130 sonnets, the first 70 or 80 or so are written to a young man who is his beloved, and he writes fairly explicitly that he refers to him as his master mistress in one sonnet, and talks about the fact that his love is not sort of shady or... some of the stereotypes of a woman being you know, not straightforward or being coy or something like that. He talks about how his male beloved is an upright, not all of those shifty things that women are. But then in the sonnet sequence, there is a shift. For a while, there's a love triangle where there's a woman involved, and she's involved with the male beloved. And then she tries to entice the speaker away. And it's, there are a bunch of weird, dark sonnets in this sequence that are complicated, and there's unhappiness, and there's lying together. And then the remainder are to a woman, and she's referred to in the scholarship as the Dark Lady. In more of the sonnets, she's described as having dark hair, dark complexion, everything that is kind of opposite the stereotype of the fair lady. And then the sonnet sequence ends in tragedy and unhappiness. So, yeah, it is interesting. But he's definitely situating himself against the sort of banal writers of his day. He's wanting to get at something more accurate, more real.
It's interesting he uses the word rare. Mm-hmm. In that, I mean, that's the one kind of descriptive word, isn't mm-hmm. it? That Heroka, mm-hmm. and she's rare.
Yeah. And
or
and,
he is rare. Whatever.
Yeah, and thus I need to find a rarer way to describe her instead of this simple way.
It just reminded me of Pastor Scott's sermon on Sunday and how he said we're ordinary people, like we're all ordinary. I started to cry, just that touched me so much more than saying we're all, what, I don't know how, but that just came into my mind when you finished that.
Yeah, we're not ideals. None of us are ideals.
It's kind of humbling, and then you feel even more special, thinking I am one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And everyone else or something. But
yeah.
Connecting.
Yeah. We're human, and we're imperfect mm-hmm. in that imperfectness. That reminds me, I made a long list of poems that I could include in this in this topic, and one that I left out in my original plan, I feel like reading. Before I leave the rose image behind, I'll read a quick American writer Dorothy Parker from 1937 wrote a very short poem called One Perfect Rose. A single flower he sent me since we met, all tenderly his messenger he chose, deep-hearted, pure, with scented dew still wet, one perfect rose. I knew the language of the floweret. My fragile leaves, it said, his heart enclose. Love long has taken for his amulet one perfect rose. Why is it no one ever sent me yet one perfect limousine, do you suppose? Ah, no, it's always just my luck to get one perfect rose. One perfect limousine. Yeah.
It'll sound like Dorothy Parker to start.
Yeah, you aren't expecting the cliched language there, but then there's the sense of humor. I was thinking about this poem by John Ciardi, if I can find it. And it's drawing from this idea of being imperfect rather than the perfect things. But it's not a flower related thing. That's fine. I'd be happy to leave them behind shortly. The flowers. Let's see. Oops, wrong page. Put these page numbers down so I wouldn't waste time in our session paging through things. But so here's an interesting image. The simile here is an arch. The title of the poem is Most Like an Arch, This Marriage. Most like an arch, an entrance which upholds and shores the stone crush up the air like lace. Mass made idea and idea held in place, a lock in time, inside half heaven unfolds. Most like an arch, two weaknesses that lean into a strength. Two fallings become firm. Two joined abeyances become a term naming the fact that teaches fact to mean. Not quite that, not much less. World as it is, what's strong and separate falters. All I do at piling stone on stone apart from you is roofless around nothing. Till we kiss, I am no more than upright and unset. It is by falling in and in we make the all-bearing point, for one another's sake, in faultless failing, raised by our own weight.
Mm-hmm. Who's the poet?
That's John Ciardi.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Died in 1986. Mm-hmm. That was a 58 poem. So, yeah, this way in which some poets take the beautiful, the ideal, and craft the love poem out of the shortfall, you know, the not quite there, it's not this, it's not that, I think is a really interesting strategy. I thought it would be fun, I don't know, I would like it if you left, you know, having a few like little threads of thought in your mind, not that one can write a poem in an hour and feel good about it, but if there's anything on this list that you want to brainstorm just for yourself for a moment about what your love is not like, and just frame some sentence or phrase that is an anti one of these things, to try to get at a fresh or original notion of love. Another strategy for generating an original love poem is to think of really great things that have nothing to do with this usual world of cliché. There was a number of years ago a song on the radio, "Your love is better than ice cream, better than anything else that I know." You know, and ice cream is not the usual sort of obvious go-to with love, but you know, that's an interesting strategy. Think of something good, but that is usually far afield from the love smarminess, and making a connection there, or doing this sort of it's not the usual cliched things. I'm going to move from Shakespeare in the 16th century. To one of the great 19th century British poets, Elizabeth Barrett Browning. The sonnet remained in vogue through the 16th century, and then it kind of disappeared for a while, mid-17th century through the 18th. The sonnet was not of much interest. Poetry turned philosophical, and there were a few women in the early 1800s. Charlotte Smith is a British writer who a lot of people don't know, but she wrote a collection called Elegiac Sonnets. It was published in 1790s. And her innovation with the sonnet form, if you know the term elegy, an elegy is a poem of loss, poems upon the death of someone or the death of an idea, an elegy for a lost age, for example. And so instead of having this usual love topic, Charlotte Smith, a set of really dark but very lovely, visually stunning, very painterly poems. And she published them, and they were wildly popular, and a bunch of the romantic poets that we know better, like Wordsworth and Coleridge, started writing sonnets again. They got taken by this form, started writing them, and so they're popular again through the 19th century. Elizabeth Barrett Browning published her famous collection, Sonnets from the Portuguese, in the year 1850. And these are not translated from the Portuguese. These are original poems of hers. But she was a serious political writer, as well as a love poem writer. And she was aware at the time that as a female poet, that if she wrote a bunch of love poems, that she might become, in the public eye, kind of marginalized as just a love poet. So she titled these as though she was translating from a passionate nation. But these are all written to her husband, Robert Browning, another poet. They had one of the great literary love affairs of the 19th century. So these are two sonnets, numbers 21 and 22. I'm going to read them both in order, and I guess I'm just interested in you noticing what she does with the common, and what she does to kind of transform or work with that common, the problem of the common in being in love. So sonnet 21. Say over again, and yet once over again, that thou dost love me. Though the word repeated should seem a cuckoo song, as thou dost treat it. Remember, never to the hill or plain, valley and wood, without the cuckoo strain, comes the fresh spring in all her green completed. Beloved, I, amidst the darkness, greeted by a doubtful spirit voice, in that doubt's pain, cry, speak once more, thou lovest. Who can fear too many stars, though each in heaven shall roll? Too many flowers, though each shall crown the year? Say thou dost love me, love me, love me. Toll the silver iterance, only minding, dear, to love me also in silence with thy soul. That follows in sequence with this one. When our two souls stand up erect and strong, face to face, silent, drawing nigh and nigher, until the lengthening wings break into fire at either curved point, what bitter wrong can the earth do to us that we should not long be here contented? Think, in mounting higher, the angels would press on us and aspire to drop some golden orb of perfect song into our deep, dear silence. Let us stay rather on earth, beloved, where the unfit, contrarious moods of men recoil away and isolate pure spirits, and permit a place to stand and love in for a day, with darkness and the death hour rounding it. Any thoughts on those responses? These are two I love. Who can fear too many stars? This line about, worrying that if the love is so pure and mounting up to the angels, that it would require the angels to show up and mess with it. Here, have our golden orb, and we're gonna do our angel-y things, to say, let's stay away from all that business. If we're down here on earth, everyone's gonna avoid us, because we're so awesomely perfect together that everyone's going to be ornery and keep their distance. And that's the space we get to have.
Seems complex. Just in hearing reading, I'm not familiar with this, that maybe it's just hard to kind of track the images. It seemed complex to me, so intriguing in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't instantly accessible, you know, what the thought was or the emotion
for me. The sonnet is a really interesting, complex form. There are very strict rules to the sonnet. They are 14 lines long and no longer. Every line has to be an iambic pentameter, which is 10 syllables long and with the particular stress pattern. It's weak, strong, weak, strong, weak, strong, weak, strong, weak, strong. And then there also has to be a rhyme scheme that is either an alternating A-B-A-B rhyme scheme, or because of the Italian form, it can go in an A-B-B-A, A-B-B-A rhyme scheme. But all of those rules have to be present at once. So writing one is complicated. You know, you have to come up with words that rhyme and that still are going to say what you want them to say. And so they're very dense and compact, and they're well worth studying carefully. And usually what I do with students in trying to understand them, because they aren't free verse. If you were at yesterday's session with Walt Whitman, you can read aloud a unit of Walt Whitman poetry, and you follow it. It's common. The statement is there. But these work with sequences of images, and this comes from the Renaissance tradition too. To be able to write a sonnet is to be pretty savvy with words and language. You have to be able to know a lot of words, fit them into the patterns, and be creative to make it work. And so each four lines of the sonnet usually have some image or idea that is central to it, and then it moves through the statement. So they are not immediate, but they are always rich. They give a lot back when one attends to them. I have kind of a math-oriented brain sometimes, and I like the form a lot. Let's see. So this idea of heaven, I thought I'd read one more on the topic of heaven, and then I'd move to a slightly different arena for a few minutes. This is a poem titled Heaven by a California poet, Laura Carithers. So this is another opportunity to kind of think about, like Elizabeth Barrett Browning, it's this sort of idea of heaven on earth a little bit. That what is here and the beauty of here, blends with the heavenly. And if this is heaven, warm skin, cool edge of sheet, and this, your face opening like morning under me, then why should we ever speak? Why not stay in the garden, where innocence changes roof to sky, daylight to starlight? Why not couple our hands and forget yours from mine? We have returned to our original purpose, to love the world. Not as it has been told to us, but as we know it now. Why move away from here and hesitate when wild geese are culling the air for spring? I see dawn breaking against the far wall and your hip turning over for my touch. There are the fruits man eats to stay alive. We make the food we eat all night. This is one I like for the ways in which it's drawing on the heaven imagery, the Eden imagery, right? The fruits in the garden, some of these things that are common associations, but using them in an unfamiliar way and pulling them together with other kinds of images, the wild geese, these sounds, and a common kind of bedroom moment that is connected, moves from the room to starlight, and goes that big.
It's feels like she pulls it back to that, to the hip or the clean sheet or the wall. But there's this whole expanse in between.
Yeah. Sometimes the very small detail can do more work to get at the big idea than trying to talk about big things. It's a great segue to the next couple of poems I had queued up. The fine attention to some small moment is a kind of attentiveness, a kind of love that gets us into the concrete instead of getting sort of washed out with this big, let me try to tell you everything I know or everything I see. And it's impossible to do that. If you can treat one small detail really accurately, really carefully, and work with what that offers, you can get at that much bigger picture. A couple examples that I thought I would pull out. You know, those traditional sonnet writers, the conventional sonnets, you know, they're all about the lips, the face, the breasts, you know, these sort of common body parts. But then the hip is a common part. Everybody's got one. But it is an intimate kind of body part, I guess. I'm going to read for you a poem by the American poet Adrienne Rich. Just died earlier this year and has left us quite a legacy. She's published a lot of books. This is from The Dream of a Common Language. And within this poem, or this book, there's a set of poems called 21 Love Poems. So this is one of those. And it is, in fact, number 6. Your small hands, precisely equal to my own. Only the thumb is larger, longer. In these hands, I could trust the world, or in many hands like these, handling power tools, or steering wheel, or touching a human face. Such hands could turn the unborn child right ways in the birth canal, or pilot the exploratory rescue ship through icebergs, or piece together the fine, needle-like sherds of a great crater cup, bearing on its sides figures of ecstatic women striding to the Sybil's Den or the Eleusinian Cave. Such hands might carry out an unavoidable violence with such restraint, with such a grasp of the range and limits of violence, that violence ever after would be obsolete. As I felt yesterday I just wanted to read Walt Whitman's Song of Myself for an hour, and I end up just feeling like, let me just read you some more of this. I'm just going to keep reading all 21 of them, and we'll just sit here and enjoy and feel moved and have a bunch of cool images in our minds. But I was told I should do a little bit more than just read some poems. What? Teach? I don't know. We're sharing. So my second example of a poem that is thinking about the body in an intimate way, but about a non-traditional detail of the body, if I can find it, is by a contemporary younger writer by the name of Kim Adonizio. This is a poem that was first published in 1994, and it's just called First Poem for You. I like to touch your tattoos in complete darkness, when I can't see them. I'm sure of where they are. I know by heart the neat lines of lightning pulsing just above your nipple, can find, as if by instinct, the blue swirls of water on your shoulder where a serpent twists, facing a dragon. When I pull you to me, taking you until we're spent and quiet on the sheets. I love to kiss the pictures in your skin. They'll last until you're seared to ashes. Whatever persists or turns to pain between us, they will still be there. Such permanence is terrifying. So I touch them in the dark, but touch them trying. I always enjoy a beautiful tattoo poem.
It'll be a whole new genre, too.
Yeah,
right.
It was a yes, please.
Sometimes I haven't written a lot of love poems, but it's almost more like stories that I've enjoyed doing. Mm-hmm. Kind of, I have one that's I wait for you like the 6-year-old I was in the train station, or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's one of them.
Yeah,
and that has been a kind of a nice way to get towards to the feelings, because it's something more an experience.
Yeah, and a nice simile. A nice simile, waiting like a 6-year-old waits. That's a very particular kind of waiting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's sometimes been the way I've gotten to some of the feelings, is like an experience, sort of.
Yeah. I think I've chosen poems for today that are kind of snapshot-like. They're sort of a moment or an image. Mm-hmm. There's something about maybe the intimacy of the love relationship that works well with a story, a telling, you know, that we want to tell our stories to one another. Other thoughts at the moment? Got time for some thoughts at this juncture? If we were in an actual writing workshop, I would probably at this juncture encourage everyone to choose an odd and very unsexy body part and do a little brainstorming of writing about it lovingly and caressingly, like the tattoo, which is, you know, maybe not, I don't know, love poem to one's knees, or a love poem to the toenail or the scapula or something like that. But
the mole,
you know, these
just below your left ear.
Mm-hmm.
The mole with the hair growing out.
There's a wonderful love poem called The Nape. I wonder if I can find that one. You know, The Nape of the Neck. Is that in this collection or not? Oh, shoot. I think I have it in a different book. Fairly contemporary writer, too. But it's a love poem, and it's about, you know, the sensitivity of this spot and the fact that even when one's hair goes gray, that's the spot that retains the hair color the longest. It's like this sort of life or youth point or something like that. And that, I'm trying to remember this poem. It might be a poem about God rather than about a person, but the final image is of being carried off like a cat carries off a kitten by the nape of the neck to safety. There's a lot of creative room to go. That, you know, every body part is a part of an intimate relationship. You know, bodies come to know one another, and we end up having that sense of being able to recognize each other even with our eyes closed or something. And so there's no part that's not worth writing about. Why keep talking about lips and roses? You know, that. That's fairly limited. Let's see. I want to read both of these. Yes, I'll read both of these. Another option beyond body parts is to write about, the love poems and passions or whatever. Is to write about a moment of togetherness that is not about necessarily the sexier, passionate, or intimate kind of moment. And there were way too many poems to choose from, but these are the two I chose. And this will have to be kind of where we pause. One is a poem by Jorge Luis Borges. I'm going to read. The original was in Spanish and was written in 1925. I am not fluent in Spanish, so I'm not going to pretend to read it because I would read it not particularly well. But Robert Fitzgerald wrote a translation in 1972. So this poem is called Anticipation of Love. Neither the intimacy of your look, your brow fair as a feast day, nor the favor of your body, still mysterious, reserved, and childlike, nor what comes to me of your life, settling in words or silence, will be so mysterious a gift as the sight of your sleep enfolded in the vigil of my arms. Virgin again, miraculously, by the absolving power of sleep, quiet and luminous like some happy thing recovered by memory, you will give me that shore of your life that you yourself do not own. Cast up into silence, I shall discern that ultimate beach of your being and see you for the first time, perhaps, as God must see you, the fiction of time destroyed, free from love, from me. Really interesting way of looking at the loved one. That childlike sleep. And this is another, there's an American poet, Jane Kenyon, who many of you might know. And this is a love poem from 1978 for her soon-to-become husband. And it's called The Suitor. And in this one, the suitor is not the character in the poem that you might think. There are two people, this opening line is going to be, we lie back to back, but keep an eye out for the simile at the end for what actually is like a suitor. We lie back to back, curtains lift and fall, like the chest of someone sleeping. Wind moves the leaves of the box elder. They show their light undersides, turning all at once like a school of fish. Suddenly, I understand that I am happy. For months, this feeling has been coming closer, stopping for short visits, like a timid suitor. Very brief poem with two wonderful similes. The trees with the leaves that turn, and they all are like bright coins all of a sudden. Like a school of fish is a wonderful connection that I think of now because I know this poem, but it was not one. I have always loved that moment when the breeze comes through and turns them. But happiness like a timid suitor. These are such sweet poems that are about the quietude of love, that carry a large feeling in a way that trying maybe to encompass the great deep passion sometimes brings us into the awkward world of cliché. So if you are a lover or in love or in love with love, there are a few maybe strategies for you to think about in trying to capture your feelings in new ways.
I keep thinking in connection with you wanting to tell a story of the love poem of your mother to you that you read on Monday,
The
which
Ehrman.
Was kind of the story, the Ehrman.
Mm-hmm.
You were curious
to
read that for you.
Yeah. I didn't bring that book with me, but yeah, it was a love poem to me when I was a teenager. In all of my awkwardness, hoping for the safe arrival. So Yeah. Well, we're at time. I hope this was enjoyable, and